We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
From Learfield IMG College, this is Aggies All the Way, the official podcast of Utah State Athletics. Aggies All the Way is presented by Guild Mortgage. Guild Mortgage Company and the Karen Nielsen team is experienced and knowledgeable with all types of loan products and can tailor the perfect loan for you. Karen and the team would love to meet you and help you own what matters. NMLS number 3274, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, welcome on in. It's the Aggies All the Way podcast with a chance to get to know the new head coach of Utah State, Ryan Odom, who's kind enough to carve out a few moments for the spring game. But Coach, I know there's a lot of people, and you've given a lot of interviews, and people want to break down X's and O's and stuff like that. But I'd rather just kind of get to know who you are as a person and maybe your background as well. And as a kid who grew up in the 80s and 90s and loved college basketball, obviously, and watched a lot of ACC basketball back in the day. Obviously, basketball's in your blood. Talk about, you know, growing up as a coach's kid and what that was like.
Yeah, first off, great to be here with you. You're so excited to be here at Utah State out here in Cache Valley and ready to get rolling here with the Aggies. But, you know, for me, you know, growing up in a coaching family is a dream come true. You know, it's certainly a blessing. You know, I loved every day of it, you know, as a youngster, being able to go to the gym with my father. You know, every young person wants to know what their father or mother, whoever's, you know, kind of the main breadwinner in their family, wants to know what they do for a living.
Yeah.
and be a part of it. And I was fortunate in that my father, when I was first born, you know, was an assistant coach at Wake. And, you know, that was back when Dean Smith was coaching and even Jim Valvano and Coach K was a young coach at Duke at that point. And so he had all these great coaches, Bobby Crimmins, you know, they had just come in the league at that point at Georgia Tech. And, you know, I was able to experience what ACC basketball was all about. And it was huge. You know, there were only eight teams, you know, in the league at that point. And then Dad went on to be a head coach at East Carolina. He was there 3 years, inherited a program that was kind of coming off of NCAA investigation and was there for a few years and did pretty well. And then Coach Holland from UVA called him, and they were number one in the country at that point.
Yeah.
They had Ralph Sampson.
Yeah.
He was three-time National Player of the Year, which hasn't happened since. 7-4. I mean, he was doing things that, you know.
And that's with the Worthy and Perkins and Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was in that era, too.
It was in that era. I was a ball boy. You know, I was a ball boy for, you know, the University of Virginia. I would sit right behind the bench of the opposing team.
Yeah.
And so I literally – would hand water. You know, they don't do that anymore. There's never ball boys that sit behind the opposing team's bench. I would literally sit there and I would listen to the huddles. You know, I heard Dean Smith, you know, talk to his team in a very polite, you know, but cerebral way. I heard Jim Valvano talk to his team in a different way. I saw Gary Williams, Bobby Crimmins, you know. I mean, you can keep on going. Cliff Ellis was coaching at Clemson at the time. Lefty Driesell.
Yeah, Maryland.
At Maryland. And so, you know, just the memories, you know, rebounding for Len Bias, you know, and throwing the ball back to Michael Jordan, you know, during warmups. Truly blessed, you know, to be able to do that.
You talk about styles, and again, it's always weird because growing up, you know, everybody talks about, you know, who was your favorite player that I watched, you know, and everybody back in that day, you know, Stackhouse and Wallace were at North Carolina, and the player that I loved was Randolph Childress.
Oh yeah,
that was my guy. I loved that even more than Tim Duncan.
Yeah,
and I don't know why you gravitate towards certain players, but I remember watching your dad coach a ton at Wake Forest, and he was really fiery and intense. And going back and watching some UMBC games, you seem a little bit more reserved. Where does that come from, and is that a conscious decision on your part?
I think I'm just a little bit different than my father, honestly. You know, my dad is definitely intense, you know, but he's guarded as well. You know, he loves his players. He's never disrespectful to his players. I mean, so I've always worked for guys that, you know, have treated people right the right way, have helped them grow, have held them accountable, you know, in the right way. But, you know, my dad always jokes about it. He said they got their love from basketball, talking about me and my brother Lane, who's a scout for the Jazz. He said they got their love for basketball from me, but they got their personality and patience from their mother. So I think the way I view that is I got the best of both. And so you have to be yourself. You know, it's funny. You watch the NBA game, you know, you don't see very many coaches hooting and hollering over there.
No.
And so that's kind of how I coach. You know, if I'm out of sorts, I don't feel that I can be my best for my team. And so that's why I coach that way.
So I've got three boys, and my oldest two never really gravitated towards sports. And I think it was almost because, you know, in their growing up years, my day job, I work for the Jazz. I did the Jazz pre-half and post-game shows. And so I was gone a lot. And I think maybe their not dislike of sports, but their going away from sports, maybe it had something to do with that. My youngest is all in. And he tells me all the time, he goes, I want to do what you do, Dad, because I think he knows he has my genetics, and so he's not going to be a player. But growing up, was it always coaching? Because sometimes it could have gone the other way. And I know you did an internship in the finance world, but was it always, I'm going to be a coach?
It definitely was not. You know, and part of it was exactly what you're saying, because my father back then, the rules were so different. It's just way easier for coaches now. Obviously, you can see players on film. You can go out and recruit them and watch them in person. You have all these different areas that you can tap into to be able to get information about young people that aspire to play in college basketball. Back then, there was no internet, you know, there was no YouTube. You
no
couldn't
synergy.
Just pull it up, no synergy. You couldn't pull up and find out about the next great player. You actually had to go out and see them. And that required my father to be gone, and other coaches during that era to be gone all the time. I mean, I can remember he was recruiting Dominique Wilkins, you know, years and years ago, Eastern North Carolina, and he was literally basically living down there, you know, where you know, Dominique was from, you know, for weeks at a time with other coaches from other doing the exact same thing. And so it was a pretty unique environment back then. And so that did, you know, it helped shape me. It gave me some concern about doing it because, you know, I'm a family guy. I love being around my kids. And you know, when it was time for me to give the ball up after playing for, you know, my entire life, you know, ending my college career, the ball meant more to me. Mm-hmm. And I was so ready to, you know, just embark on a coaching career. My brother was coaching at the time. My father was at the height of his coaching career in the ACC. And so I wanted to see where it took me. And it's brought me here, which is a cool thing.
Because I referenced my youngest son. He's like, yeah, I want to call games like you, Dad. I'm like, you need to find a stable job, doctor, lawyer.
Don't
do this. Did your dad ever say, like, hey, you know, maybe you should go into finance? I mean, what were those conversations like?
I think most dads do it that way. I mean, I think I feel like I'm that way with my son as well, because, you know, there's always, if there's a level, certain level of success that the father has, then the next generation, it becomes, it's not, it, most people think it's just going to be easy.
Yeah.
No, it's actually harder, you know, because you've got, you know, that to look up to. You know, people expect, you know, you to do necessarily what your father did, yeah, or as well as your father did. And so there's a pressure that comes with that. And it does certainly open doors. I'm not, you know, ignoring that fact. It definitely does open doors to be able to enter into that world. But it's never a guarantee. You got to do the work on your own. And that's one of the things that I'm most proud of, is I've never worked for my father. You know, I've kind of had to go about it on my own.
There was a moment that I was reading up where your son was dealing with some significant medical issues. The staff had just been let go at Charlotte. It was before you got your first head coaching job. How did that time kind of mold you into who you are, not only as a coach, but as a father and as a dad and all that, as who you are now?
Yeah, I wouldn't be sitting here, you know, with you right now had we not had to go through that time. And I believe that's what any successful person, you know, has in their life. They went through something in order to get there. It didn't just happen, you know, for sheer luck, or there was a bigger purpose there. And, you know, for us, my wife, you know, Lucia was amazing during that time. She was the rock. She was the strong one that kind of led the charge through that to help, mm-hmm, you know, Connor kind of recover, you know, from his bout with OCD. And it's still a daily thing. I mean, he's still, OCD doesn't just go away. You know, it's something that you deal with. And it can be a positive, you know, force for you later on in life. But when you're going through it as a 13 to 19-year-old kid like he's done, it's not easy. And there's always doubt, you know, that enters in there. And my wife, you know, was tremendous during that time and really led us. And, you know, I didn't really realize the depth of the challenge that we were under at that point until we got fired and I was in the house every day.
Yeah.
And then I began to realize, oh, boy, this is a lot worse than even I knew, because you get wrapped up in your work and, you know, you go away in the morning and then you come back at night, so you don't see what happens in that in-between time. And that really has helped shape, you know, us as a family. And it's something that, you know, we've dealt with and we've come through the other side of it. And, you know, we're certainly stronger for it. Our faith is stronger and you know, we're doing well, thankfully, now.
That's awesome to hear. What was the experience at Lenore Ryan like? Because when I hear you talk about it, and I've listened to a lot of interviews you've given and podcasts and things like that, it sure seems like that was a special time.
It really was. I mean, again, that's another reason I would not be here if it wasn't for those kids and Neil McGahey who hired me. I mean, I was at a tough spot in my life, and I'd never coached Division II. I played Division III, so I knew kind of like what that meant, you know, and you're riding on buses and vans and, you know, there's no budget, and it's like you got to wash the clothes at your house. I mean, literally, I had to wash the uniforms. My assistant and I, Nate, who's here with me, we wash the uniforms at our house, you know, just to get them ready for the next game. And so you do everything.
That's crazy. Yeah.
And, but what I walked into was so special. These kids, I mean, they welcomed me and our staff in. They did everything that we asked them to do. We recruited a couple of guys to fit in with those guys that were returning. And, you know, we had what was one of the most special years I'll never forget. You know, Sweet 16 NCAA tournament, we played, you know, what ended up being the national runner-up, our first game at home in conference play. We lost in four overtimes.
Wow.
I mean, it was an incredible game. One of the best games I've ever been a part of. And one of those players is with me here on our staff at UMBC, Billy Bales. And he still – he helped over, and then we were up three, and he helped over – and then they threw it to his man, and the guy made a three on him. So he still talks about that. He's like, I can't believe I helped. What happened?
Of all the good things, he always remembered the one little two things you do wrong.
I walked into some amazing people, and that I'll have lifelong relationships with.
Everybody wants to talk about the 116 upset, and I know you've talked about that ad nauseum, but in doing a little research on that team, I thought it was really fascinating where – you know, you got Jarius Lyles, who took a long route to get to UMBC. Your point guard took a bit of a route to get there. And I don't want to say, cast-offs isn't the right word, but guys that maybe a lot of the college basketball world gave up on, yeah. and you didn't, and you ended up having, you know, an incredible win against Vermont in the conference championship and obviously the 16-1 upset. Is that – do you kind of gravitate towards the kids that that may have that kind of a chip on their shoulder?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you've been through some adversity, I think naturally, you know, you have that chip on your shoulder to be able to prove people wrong. And, you know, I think that was actually part of my speech to the team before the game, before the Virginia game, was, you know, if you look around the room, you know, coaches included, I mean, I would have put myself in that same category.
Yeah.
You know, I'd been fired and been, you know, had some hard luck at times. And you know, you go around the room, you know, KJ Mara had been let go at Abilene Christian, who had an amazing year this year. Jairus Lyles didn't go well with Shaka and wasn't Shaka's fault.
Yeah.
It was Jairus, you know, at VCU, and then went to Robert Morris and then ended up at UMBC. There was as you went around the room, that was the common theme. And then you went into the coaching staff and it was very similar. And so, you know, what I had told them was, I just wanted to thank you, you know, for bringing me back to this moment, all right, or this opportunity here in the NCAA tournament. And I mean, I literally lived a mile from that arena.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's where Connor was sick. You know, that's where we were dealing with all of that adversity. And we were a mile and a half away from our home, you know. And I thank those kids for bringing me back to that moment. But I also added to it, I said, you're here for a reason right now. It's not just me that's back here. You know, you've been through a ton of stuff as well to get to this moment. You've earned this. And so wouldn't it be a shame if we were afraid to go for it? And so, you know, the guys went out there and the rest is history. I mean, not because of the speech,
yeah.
but that was the thought process, was we have nothing to be afraid of. Let's go. Let's try it.
The sports world could be just crazy. I mean, you're playing a game, you know, a mile away from where you know, you had lived and in the school that had let you go. You're playing against the team that you rode your bike to practice when your dad was an assistant at UVA. Yeah. I mean, that had to be just a weird, surreal moment for you.
No, it's a movie.
It really is.
It's a crazy movie.
Dennis Quaid's going to do on the Disney flick for you.
I mean, it's nuts. I mean, especially the way that they finished the next year and watching them you know, them recover from that moment too, because I mean, there were death threats, you know, I mean, for them, the bus, can you imagine the bus out of, you know, the whatever that arena is, I can't even remember the name of the Charlotte Coliseum, but tough ending for them, and how they recovered from that to win the national championship. I mean, that's a special story.
You've talked about recruiting a little bit. What's and maybe this isn't a fair question to ask, but is there one or two attributes that you look at for a kid, regardless of position, that he needs to have if he's going to play for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, character would be the first thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a huge thing with me. You know, I'm not big into taking risks, you know, with kids that, you know, don't want to be great. You know, I want guys that they want to chase excellence in all parts of their life. And that's not to say that they don't know that that's what they want, you know, at that point. Maybe they're chasing it in only basketball, but, you know, academically they're really smart, but they just kind of just slide through because they are smart. And so it's my job as a coach to push them in all areas of their life. But character would be the first. Talent, you know, would be the second. Do they have, you know, do they have talent to play and a love to play the game? Are they passionate about the game? Are they willing to go through the hard times to be able to be successful? Because that's what it takes. Like, you're going to have these really hard moments, these uncomfortable moments, in order to cut down nets, you know, and make it to the NCAA tournament and have success. It's not going to be easy. It's not meant to be easy. And so those that understand that and have been through some things. And then, you know, do they fit, you know, the place that I work at, Utah State? Do they fit this community? And do they fit this school and our style of play? And, you know, I think grit and toughness and those kinds of things all kind of encompass that. But, I mean, I think I love guys that offensively can dribble, pass, and shoot.
Yeah.
You know, I know that sounds very simplistic, but not everybody can do it. And so, you know, that's an area certain that we try to size for position. Are they smart?
When you're recruiting a kid, more often than not, he's probably the best player on his team. You know, if you're recruiting a guy to come to the Mountain West, chances are he's the one or two best players on his high school team or junior college team or whatever the case might be. And it's easy to disguise toughness when you're the best player on the team or the best player in your conference.
Yeah.
How hard is it as a coach to identify those little intangible grit, toughness, when they're already a pretty good athlete and they're able to kind of maybe skate by based on the level of competition?
Yeah, I think you can see it. I mean, when you go watch them, that's why we like to watch them not only with their high schools, but we watch them, you know, in AAU and summer camps and things like that that happen. You know, certain kids are from overseas, so you're watching them with their national teams playing against, you know, their age group or above. You know, sometimes they're playing against men, you know. You know, how do they operate on the court? You know, are they a good teammate? You know, are they somebody that when they make a bad pass and it goes out of bounds or it goes off his teammate's hand, are they blaming the teammate or are they somebody that's walking over and say, hey, we'll get the next one? Are they a good teammate? That's a huge thing. Because if they think it's all about them, this is probably not the place for them. It's definitely not the place for them.
Yeah.
And so we try to create a true team here, a unit that cares about one another. That's one of the things that I've been most excited about since coming to Utah State and being around these guys for a week and a half or however long I've been. You know, Craig and his staff have created a culture of winning and a culture where they really care about one another. And this team last year was very connected.
Yeah.
Even though we've had a couple of guys move on to other places, all right, they when they were together, because every season brings a new chance, a new opportunity, last year's team was a connected group. And so we just want to build upon that.
I mentioned my day job is with the Jazz, and I had a conversation with Dennis a little bit about you, and I guess you recruited his son.
We did. Yeah. Coach Dixon actually recruited Matt, and obviously his older brother played at Baylor and now works, I think, for the Jazz, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a great opportunity to go out and watch Jarris, who played for me at UMBC, when he was playing for the Salt Lake
Stars. Yeah, the Stars, G League team.
And so Jarris was a part of the, you know, the training camp. And so I came out, I watched training camp with you know, the staff. Quinn let me, you know, get in some of the meetings there and hang out and learn. But I also had a chance to spend some time with Dennis, and he's an awesome guy. You know, I learned a ton, you know, just kind of being around him, you know, for a couple of days.
Yeah, he said his mom wasn't going to let him leave Salt Lake.
Yeah, there's no
That's
chance.
Why he ended up with Slick. Yeah. I wanted to Quinn, you know, released a statement and said that he's known you and your wife for decades. What was the genesis of that relationship?
Well, he was coaching at Duke. So this was after he graduated, you know, from Duke. He went and did a few things. I can think NBA, and then he was with the Clippers, and then he kind of came back. He was with Larry Brown, and then he came back to Duke in that kind of off-the-court role for a couple of years. That's when Dad was coaching at Wake.
Okay.
And then he moved up, you know, into an assistant coaching role. My brother was getting into coaching at the same time. They're about the same age. And my brother played at High Point and then graduated and then went to Alabama for Wimp Sanderson and was a GA down there. Then moved up and was coaching at Alabama for a couple of years. And then he moved to ECU when Quinn was at Duke.
Okay.
And so that's when they connected, similar ages. Dad was coaching at Wake, like I said. And so they were always, you know, kind of communicating. And then Lane went to Charlotte, coached a couple of years with Lutz, Bobby Lutz. And then he went to Missouri with Quinn when Quinn got the job. Actually, the second year. Quinn had taken the job the first year, and then he had an opening. John Hammond actually left, and then he hired Lane to go to Missouri. And so they were out there together for a number of years. But that's when we first met back then.
I was going to say Thanksgiving dinner, but no college coaches around for Thanksgiving. So when you – whatever the summer, and you've got your dad and Lane, and you're sitting around a table eating some food, do you guys talk shop or do you stay away from
– They were out here this week.
I saw that,
yeah. They came out this week. So they were out here all week with the players hanging around. Going in the weight room, watching them lift, and in the, on the court, watching them, you know, work out with us and our staff, and you know, it was fun. It's always fun. Dad just loves the game so much. Lane loves it so much. You know, they were for them to be around us, you know, this week and this new opportunity was really special. Just two sons and a dad who've grown up in the game, and you know, he left here feeling, you know, really good about the Aggies and the opportunity.
What in being recruited, I guess maybe that's not the right word. Maybe it is as a coach. When John Hartwell's and you are going back and forth about the job, were you in the year of COVID and not being able to travel as much, is it weird coming into a place and seeing it for a first time after taking the job?
It is, yeah. I mean, it definitely was a little bit weird, but we had been out, you know, I'd seen online. I mean, now you can see kind of everything online, and you kind of know what you're getting into in terms of the pictures are so great, the videos, you know, all the things that, you know, every university has nowadays kind of give you a little bit of a snapshot of it. And we were familiar with the area, you know, because we'd vacationed out here. Lucy and I and our boys have been out here several times, you know, to the area, and obviously going back to when we were getting engaged, you know, it goes back to that as well. So, you know, we were excited about, you know, Logan and the opportunity to be here in Cache Valley.
When I watch, and again, now you've forgotten more about basketball than I'll ever know, but the one thing that really jumped out to me when I watch your teams play and going back and watching film, ball never sticks.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, I got to imagine that's a big philosophy of yours.
That's a huge thing. And watching this current team from last year, I mean, very similar. You know, the guys move the ball. You know, open guy a lot of times is a go-to guy. And I know they obviously, you know, had a focus of getting the ball to Nimi last year, rightfully so. But I do think, you know, the fast, that's where the game is now. I mean, you just watch the NBA, you watch the best teams in college basketball, Gonzaga last year, even Baylor, obviously, who won it. You watch, you know, the Utah Jazz just right down the road. I mean, that ball is moving.
Yeah.
And it's hard to keep up. And so that's how we like to play. You know, I love the ball moving, and I like guys making plays for one another. That creates a connectivity that's really, really positive. And when it sticks, it's not the same. And so we call that getting the other team in scramble. We want them scrambling around chasing us.
One thing that, you know, you watch Baylor, and obviously to replicate what Baylor did is going to be ridiculous. But, I mean, you had a bunch of dudes that were like 6'7 to 6'9, and they could switch 1 through 5 and just create all kinds of havoc. And that kind of feels like the direction the game's kind of going right now.
Yeah, no question. Size for position is really important. It doesn't mean the small guy is out.
Yeah.
You know, because I've certainly had some of the best around. You know,
that yeah, what a 5'8" guy that was the defensive player of the year.
He was, yeah. KJ Mara, the kid that we – our point guard when we beat Virginia, he was defensive player of the year, and he was about 145 pounds, you know, and you know, really impressive. But and then we had Darnell last year, Darnell Rogers, smallest player to probably ever play in college basketball. But you know, I do love the size that we have here. You know, I like the ability to switch. I like the ability to keep other teams in front and make them score over top.
What was it like? I mean, you have so much basketball history, but nothing could have prepared anybody for what we saw last year. Obviously, Utah State had its challenges and lost some games. I know you guys only got 20 games in at UMBC. What was it like trying to coach from your perspective in a year of a pandemic?
It was extremely difficult. I was extremely proud of our guys. You know, we went a whole year without a guy testing positive for COVID.
Oh, wow.
Not one player. We had one person in our program that was not a player test positive the entire year. And so that's a credit not only to our guys, but also to – you know, the athletic training folks, and then obviously our administration for even letting us play.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have to. You know, that's the unique thing about COVID. And, you know, it was really difficult because you had to be very nimble. You had to understand, you know, all of a sudden you're supposed to play this team on Saturday. Oop, they test positive in non-conference. Oop, we're going to play another team, and you had to pivot and do a whole new scouting report, you know, for another team. And so you did see some weird scores, you know, from time to time because of that. But all in all, it was definitely worth it. You know, we were able to get a ring together, a regular season championship, you know, at UMBC. So I feel good about, you know, where we left the program, you know, there.
How difficult was that decision? I mean, so many roots out there and so much success out there. And just seeing the response of UMBC fans on social media, they absolutely loved you and your family and the teams that you developed. That's got to be a hard thing to do.
It was extremely difficult. You know, I'd always said in my mind, you know, it's going to take a really special place, you know, for me to leave. And Utah certainly provided that. And working, you know, arm in arm with a guy like John Hartwell, I'd always said it was going to be – you know, it was going to take that as well. You know, somebody that I felt, you know, I could do it with. And because it's not one coach, you know, it's not one player, you know, it's a collective, collaborative effort, you know, by everybody involved administratively, you know, from the president on down, to have a top 25 basketball program. And I think that's what we aspire to be. Are we going to be that every year? You know, only time will tell. But I do know that we have all the tools in place to have a great basketball program, or continue to have a great basketball program. You know, our goal certainly is to make the NCAA tournament year in and year out and compete for championships. But we want to be a team that advances in the NCAA tournament and be a team that people, when they say the Aggies, ooh, I don't want to play the Aggies first round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing about this conference, too, and I'm, as a coach, I'm sure you love the opportunity, but there's so many different variations of styles. I mean, you got a San Diego State team that can create all kinds of problems. You got Air Force that goes old school Princeton. I mean, this is – it's kind of got to be fun as a coach, and maybe a little bit scary as a coach, too, to see the different varying styles that you have inside this conference.
It is, no question. And you know, I got used to the America East and you know, coaching in it for 5 years or whatever it ended up being, and you get used to tendencies from the coaches and kind of how they play and the styles. So it is fun. I mean, you have to continue to evolve, you know, as a coach. And – it's certainly a challenge that we're excited about. You know, they're great coaches in this league. And I know there was a couple of changes, including ourselves, you know, within the league. But, I mean, this is a league that you know, has great coaching, and it also has big-time basketball players that go on and play at the next level, whether it's in the NBA, which we've obviously had, you know, here, and then overseas as well, where, I mean, overseas, there's tremendous players over there, you know, that play 13 years. For a long time. And so we're excited about the challenge, and I'm excited about our staff coming out here, you know, from UMBC, and they know me. There's a trust level. We have a way of doing things. And so it's going to be a lot easier for us to kind of implement that here at Utah State.
When you look across the recruiting landscape and you go into a kid's room and say, at Utah State, you know, what do you want to do? And the kid's going to be like, I want to play in the league. All right, well, we got a draft pick 2 years ago. We'll probably have a draft pick this year. Yeah. That's probably got to help out in a big way.
No, it's huge. I mean, it really is, because not everybody can say that.
Yeah.
And I think I've said it before. It's not like this everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt about it. We've got a fan base that is, you know, so excited about hoops and loves basketball. They love all the Aggie sports. But that spectrum, you know, magic is real. And you know, I'm excited to be a part of that. And so I think that's one of the first things when you look at, you know, from a recruiting perspective, being able to attract folks. Do they care about your sport?
Yeah.
And certainly there's no doubt about it. It's one of the top five in all of college atmospheres in all of college basketball. And then do you have success? You know, have you had recent success? And do you have players that have gone on to play in the NBA? And Sam's representing us so well right now, you know, in the NBA. We have other guys overseas, you know, JC still playing over there, you know, doing big things. And, you know, the tradition here is really special. I mean, we've had old, you know, some of the old guys come back and play with our current guys the last 2 weeks. And to see them kind of interact with current players, again, it's not like that everywhere, you know. And they're a part of that mentoring process for young people.
So I just had about four or five really quick questions here.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've already kept you way too long here, but
no,
random questions just to get to know you a little bit better.
Okay.
How long after you accepted the job did somebody bring up that you got to beat BYU?
Because
I got to imagine it's probably pretty quick.
It was probably pretty quick. Yeah. I think I would say it was probably at the press conference, you know, after I had finished.
I did a thing with Coach Anderson when he got hired as the football coach. And we did it was like a Facebook Live thing. And we were reading questions as they came in. And I told him before, I'm like, over under 2.5 before BYU, and it's going to be the under.
Yeah.
And sure enough, second question. But you love that passion. That stuff from the fan base.
You love the rivalries, right?
Yeah.
And on a much smaller level, UMBC Vermont became that.
I noticed that.
Yeah, it wasn't that initially when we first got there, because we were kind of at the bottom of the conference. But then all of a sudden, you know, it was year in and year out. Everybody was ready for that game. Duke Carolina, you know. I don't know who's Kentucky's. Who would there's
Louisville, maybe.
Kentucky, yeah. Louisville. I mean, obviously, you know, BYU, Utah State is a big one.
Who was a better athlete growing up, you or Lane?
Definitely me. I hate to be – I can't not be – I should be humble there, but it's probably me.
You're on the road. Maybe, let's see, it's a recruiting trip. You're popping in Spotify or iTunes. What are you listening to?
gosh, I listen to everything. Yeah. I mean, I'll listen to Frank Sinatra. I'll listen to Dave Matthews. I'll listen to, you know, all different kinds of music. I love Amy Winehouse. She's very good. You know, I'll listen to jazz. Like, I listen to jazz, you know, because I love jazz. And I just kind of started listening to that this past year. Nice. So if we're on the road, I'm on the bus, and I don't want to hear any kind of, like, no words,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, just tune out.
I'll go straight to jazz. But Dave Matthews was coming up. He used to play. I went to Hampton Sydney College, so he literally used to play on fraternity decks I was in college.
So you got in way early then.
Oh, yeah. No, he would play every Tuesday and Wednesday night at two different places, one in Charlottesville and one in Richmond. And so I saw him in very intimate environments. I actually went last year. My wife and I went to see him in Tennessee in a place called Blackberry Farm, and there was probably 150 people there.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was just him and playing acoustic, but it was pretty cool.
Late in the game, you're up three. Do you foul?
Yes, I like to foul. Depends on the time, though.
Yeah.
You know, how much time's left.
8 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do coaches usually have kind of like a set time on when you go for it?
Yeah, it's about eight usually. You know, I mean, and sometimes you have to teach them actually as well, you know, because it doesn't go exactly always as planned, you know, and some teams will throw it to half court, call timeout. That's a different decision because now those 8 seconds, they throw it in. You know, if you get all the way to three seconds and they're throwing it inside out of bounds, probably not. So it's all situational.
Yeah, and it's always interesting because everybody wants to second guess. And do you guard the inbound or you drop everybody back? And I mean,
you've seen it both ways.
Yeah,
I mean, we made a three 2 years ago. We were down three and we threw it to half court, called timeout. We had 1.6, ran a play, and made a shot to go into OT. So they couldn't foul us because we threw it all the way to half court. And so it's just, you know, the game tells you what you need to do. You just got to practice it.
I was listening, again, an interview you gave, and I thought it was really interesting about how on that last – speaking of last shot, the shot against Vermont, and I don't believe you called timeout.
Yeah.
And you were calling in a play, and your players waved it off.
They waved it, yeah.
And you appreciated that.
Oh, yeah.
Like a lot of coaches have an ego and say, no, you run my damn play.
No, they were right. They were right. And so, you know, it's happening fast. I did not want to call timeout, and my best player had the ball.
Like, yeah.
So he didn't rebound it. Somebody else did, but he went to get it pretty quickly, and he had it in his hands. Clock's running down. You know, we had probably, I don't know if it was 20 seconds, 18 seconds, or something like that. I didn't want to call timeout because I didn't want them to get set and be able to double up on him. And so we had a play call, which would have required him to give the ball up to get it back. And so my point guard was like, no. He was like, no, don't do that. And he was correct. And then it just became, all right, we got to get everybody in position now that he's got it to run our secondary play there. And it worked out. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when you go through things like that, you know, over the course of 2 years, I had coached those kids for 2 years. They were veterans. Like they had been in really tough situations before. And, you know, I'm not saying it's like Brady and Belichick, but you have a level of trust, you know, that's established and earned. And there's no, I don't have to make the right call, you know, or make the play or call the timeout to draw up the play. I don't have that kind of an ego. Like, I just want the best shot we can get. And they were correct. And he needed to keep the ball. It was his moment. And so it happened.
I love that story, too. And it seems like when you get to the team where you want it to be, a lot of your offense is based on those guys making their own correct decisions out on the court.
Yeah, no question. I mean, it's like coaches can only do so much. I mean, it's putting guys in position to be successful. And sometimes the ball just doesn't go in the basket.
Yeah.
You know, you can run a play perfectly, and it's drawn up by the coach perfectly. It's executed perfectly, but it just doesn't go in. And so those are the ones that you kind of have to live with. You have to live with the result if you've done everything that you can, you know, to make it happen. And that's something that we teach our guys year in and year out. It's like we can't judge ourselves on the result. It's what did we do, all right, along the way? Did we do things to the best of our ability? Did we try our hardest? All right, did we execute? Did we play it smart? All right, and if the result, you know, is not what we wanted, but we did everything the way that we set out to do, well, then you can live with the result. It doesn't mean we have to like it, but it is what it is.
Do you, when you're maybe first coaching a team or building a team, maybe those first years, do you run more sets initially, or you just let them go right out of the gate?
No, I mean, I'm not a let them go coach necessarily. It's more just, you know, we establish how we're going to play. It's a faster style, all right? It's multiple ball handlers. It's pick and rolls. It's, you know, actions into pick and roll, you know, it's quick things, you know, quick actions to get into pick and roll. We work a lot on decisions out of pick and roll.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are the two guys in the pick and roll doing? And then what are the other three guys that aren't in the pick and roll? What's their role? And it's all about trying to get an advantage and gain an advantage on offense and then keep an advantage. And we try to do that within the first 7 to 10 seconds. And if we don't have it, we keep searching. And you'll hear us say that all the time. Keep searching for that advantage and try to get it. And then ultimately, if you can keep it, you'll get a great shot. Yeah. And there's times certainly that we'll run sets. You know, I'm probably guilty of having too many plays like most coaches. And I'm always adding things as the year goes on because scouting is a big thing. I mean, you know, I know this past staff was excellent, you know, at scouting the opponent's, you know, tendencies and being ready, you know, for whatever that team is going to throw at them offensively and taking strengths away. And so you have to continue to evolve and be tough to guard.
I'm sure there's a lot of kids that say they want to play in that style, but the responsibility and the learning curve, I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a, you know, you're overwhelming them with stuff, but you place a lot of responsibility on them to know where they need to be and be on the right call and all that stuff.
No question. And you know, I think a lot of kids want to play fast, but they don't necessarily want to be in the shape that they need to be to in order to play fast. And so that's a major part of it is being in tip-top shape. You got to be in the best shape of your life if you want to play fast. And so we work really hard on that. And we work a lot on decision-making in practice, you know, and what's the right shot, you know, for the individual or for our, more importantly, for our team. And, you know, we work a ton on, you know, attacking the paint, you know, getting inside the paint. And I know that was a focus for last year's team, you know, as well. And so I think some of the stuff will be very similar. The terminology will be different from time to time. And there'll be a little bit of a learning curve, you know, whenever it's new, that's just how it is. But, you know, I do love the mood and the tempo of the team so far.
Finally, before I let you go, what's it like as a, you know, the first month of being is like drinking from a fire hose? Like,
it is.
I can't imagine how difficult that
is. Yeah, it totally is. I mean, you end up with you feel bad because you have so many text messages coming through and people that really care about you, you know, that care about not only the Aggie program but the individual as well. And it's hard to answer all those. There's just not enough time in a day.
Yeah.
And trying to do it, you know, I try to go back to it in the middle of the night while I'm sitting in bed just to send a text message back and thank them and let them know how much I appreciate it. But it's just there's not enough time in a day. So my primary focus has been with the players, the current roster, obviously the recruiting, my staff, you know, getting them in place and getting them acclimated. But you think about it, there's so many things that go into a move, you know, from – you know, selling the house where you're currently living and getting that organized. And my wife's, you know, busy with that, finishing school there for your kids, finding a new place to live out here, you know, getting new keys, getting, you know, swipes and all the different, learning the campus, learning the community, meeting new
mountains
people.
Mountains like of paperwork.
I mean, there's so many things, you know, that go into a change like this. But, you know, it's all fun.
Well, Coach, appreciate it. Again, I feel like it took way too much of your time, but it was fun just getting to know you. And, again, throughout the season, you and I will have a chance to chat probably more than you want, but looking forward to it.
No, me too. Thanks.
This has been Aggies All the Way, the official podcast of Utah State Athletics, presented by Guild Mortgage. Guild Mortgage Company and the Karen Nielsen team is experienced and knowledgeable with all types of loan products and can tailor the perfect loan for you. Karen and the team would love to meet you and help you own what matters. NMLS number 3274, Equal Housing Lender. The proceeding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Aggie Sports Network.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.